of pain similarly, which patient suffered more? No contest. There is general agreement that patient B had the worst time. Patient B spent at least as much time as patient A at any level of pain, and the area under the curve is clearly larger for B than for A. The key factor, of course, is that B's procedure lasted much longer. I will call the measures based on reports of momentary pain hedonometer totals. When the procedure was over, all participants were asked to rate the total amount of pain they had experienced during the procedure. The wording was intended to encourage them to think of the integral of the pain they had reported, reproducing the hedonometer totals. Surprisingly, the patients did nothing of the kind. The statistical analysis revealed two findings, which illustrate a pattern we have observed in other experiments. Peak end rule. The global respective rating was well predicted by the average of the level of pain reported at the worst moment of the experience and at its end. Duration neglect. The duration of the procedure had no effect whatsoever on the ratings of total pain. You can now apply these rules to the profiles of patients A and B. The worst rating, 8 on the 10-point scale, was the same for both patients, but the last rating before the end of the procedure was 7 for patient A and only 1 for patient B. The peak end average was therefore 7.5 for patient A and only 4.5 for patient B. As expected, patient A retained a much worse memory of the episode than patient B. It was the bad luck of patient A that the procedure ended at a bad moment, leaving him with an unpleasant memory. We now have an embarrassment of riches. Two measures of experienced utility, the hedonometer total and the retrospective assessment, that are systematically different. The hedonometer totals are computed by an observer from an individual's report of the experience of moments. We call these judgments duration-weighted because the computation of the area under the curve assigns equal weights to all moments. 2 minutes of pain at level 9 is twice as bad as 1 minute at the same level of pain. However, the findings of this experiment and others show that the retrospective assessments are insensitive to duration and weight to singular moments, the peak and the end, much more than others. So which should matter? What should the physician do? The choice has implications for medical practice. We noted that if the objective is to reduce patients' memory of pain, lowering the peak intensity of pain could be more important than minimizing the duration of the procedure. By the same reasoning, gradual relief may be preferable to abrupt relief if patients retain a better memory when the pain at the end of the procedure is relatively mild. If the objective is to reduce the amount of pain actually experienced, conducting the procedure swiftly may be appropriate even if doing so increases the peak pain intensity and leaves patients with an awful memory. Which of the two objectives did you find most compelling? I have not conducted a proper survey, but my impression is that a strong majority will come down in favor of reducing the memory of pain. I find it helpful to think of this dilemma as a conflict of interests between two selves, which do not correspond to the two familiar systems. The experiencing self is the one that answers the question, "Does it hurt now?" The remembering self is the one that answers the question, "How was it on the whole?" Memories are all we get to keep from our experience of living, and the only perspective that we can adopt as we think about our lives is therefore that of the remembering self. A comment I heard from a member of the audience after a lecture illustrates the difficulty of distinguishing memories from experiences. He told of listening raptly to a long symphony on a disc that was scratched near the end, producing a shocking sound, and he reported that the bad ending ruined the whole experience. But the experience was not actually ruined, only the memory of it. The experiencing self had had an experience that was almost entirely good, and the bad end could not undo it because it had already happened. My questioner had assigned the entire episode a failing grade because it had ended very badly, but that grade effectively ignored 40 minutes of musical bliss. Does the actual experience count for nothing? Confusing experience with the memory of it is a compelling cognitive illusion, and it is the substitution that makes us believe a past experience can be ruined. The experiencing self does not have a voice. The remembering self is sometimes wrong, but it is the one that keeps score and governs what we learn from living, and it is the one that makes decisions. What we learn from the past is to maximize the qualities of our future memories, not necessarily of our future experience. This is the tyranny of the remembering self. Which self should count? To demonstrate the decision-making power of the remembering self, my colleagues and I designed an experiment using a mild form of torture that I will call the cold hand situation. Its ugly technical name is cold presser. Participants are asked to hold their hand up to the wrist in painfully cold water until they are invited to remove it and are offered a warm towel. The subjects in our experiment used their free hand to control arrows on a keyboard to provide a continuous record of the pain they were enduring, a direct communication from their experiencing self. We chose a temperature that caused moderate but tolerable pain. The volunteer participants were, of course, free to remove their hand at any time, but none chose to do so. Each participant endured two cold hand episodes. The short episode consisted of 60 seconds of immersion in water at 14 degrees Celsius, which is experienced as painfully cold, but not intolerable. At the end of the 60 seconds, the experimenter instructed the participant to remove his hand from the water and offered a warm towel. The long episode lasted 90 seconds. Its first 60 seconds were identical to the short episode. The experimenter said nothing at all at the end of the 60 seconds. Instead, he opened a valve that allowed slightly warmer water to flow into the tub. During the additional 30 seconds, the temperature of the water rose by roughly 1 degree, just enough for most subjects to detect a slight decrease in the intensity of pain. Our participants were told that they would have 3 cold hand trials, but in fact they experienced only the short and the long episodes, each with a different hand. The trials were separated by 7 minutes. 7 minutes after the second trial, the participants were given a choice about the third trial. They were told that one of their experiences would be repeated exactly, and were free to choose whether to repeat the experience they had had with their left hand or with their right hand. Of course, half the participants had the short trial with the left hand, half with the right. Half had the short trial first, half began with the long, etc. This was a carefully controlled experiment. The experiment was designed to create a conflict between the interests of the experiencing and the remembering selves, and also between experienced utility and decision utility. From the perspective of the experiencing self, the long trial was obviously worse. We expected the remembering self to have another opinion. The peak-end rule predicts a worse memory for the short than for the long trial, and duration neglect predicts that the difference between 90 seconds and 60 seconds of pain will be ignored. We therefore predicted that the participants would have a more favorable or less unfavorable memory of the long trial and choose to repeat it. They did. Fully 80% of the participants who reported that their pain diminished during the final phase of the longer episode opted to repeat it, thereby declaring themselves willing to suffer 30 seconds of needless pain in the anticipated third trial. The subjects who preferred the long episode were not masochists and did not deliberately choose to expose themselves to the worse experience. They simply made a mistake. If we had asked them, "Would you prefer a 90-second immersion or only the first part of it?" they would certainly have selected the short option. We did not use these words, however, and the subjects did what came naturally. They chose to repeat the episode of which they had the less aversive memory. The subjects knew quite well which of the two exposures was longer. We asked them. But they did not use that knowledge. Their decision was governed by a simple rule of intuitive choice. Pick the option you like the most or dislike the least. Rules of memory determined how much they disliked the two options, which in turn determined their choice. The cold hand experiment, like my old injections puzzle, revealed a discrepancy between decision utility and experienced utility. The preferences we observed in this experiment are another example of the less is more effect that we have encountered on previous occasions. One was Christopher Shee's study, in which adding dishes to a set of 24 dishes lowered the total value because some of the added dishes were broken. Another was Linda, the activist woman who is judged more likely to be a feminist bank teller than a bank teller. The similarity is not accidental. The same operating feature of System 1 accounts for all three situations. System 1 represents sets by averages, norms, and prototypes, not by sums. Each cold hand episode is a set of moments, which the remembering self stores as prototypical moment. This leads to a conflict. For an objective observer, evaluating the episode from the reports of the experiencing self, what counts is the area under the curve that integrates pain over time. It has the nature of a sum. The memory that the remembering self keeps, in contrast, is a representative moment, strongly influenced by the peak and the end. Of course, evolution could have designed animals' memory to store integrals, as it surely does in some cases. It is important for a squirrel to know the total amount of food it has stored, and a representation of the average size of the nuts would not be a good substitute. However, the integral of pain or pleasure over time may be less biologically significant. We know, for example, that rats show duration neglect for both pleasure and pain. In one experiment, rats were consistently exposed to a sequence in which the onset of a light signals that an electric shock will soon be delivered. The rats quickly learned to fear the light, and the intensity of their fear could be measured by several physiological responses. The main finding was that the duration of the shock has little or no effect on fear. All that matters is the painful intensity of the stimulus. Other classic studies showed that electrical stimulation of specific areas in the rat brain, and of corresponding areas in the human brain, produce a sensation of intense pleasure, so intense in some cases that rats who can stimulate their brain by pressing a lever will die of starvation without taking a break to feed themselves. Pleasurable electrical stimulation can be delivered in bursts that vary in intensity and duration. Here again, only intensity matters. Up to a point, increasing the duration of a burst of stimulation does not appear to increase the eagerness of the animal to obtain it. The rules that govern the remembering self of humans have a long evolutionary history. Biology versus rationality. The most useful idea in the injections puzzle that preoccupied me years ago was that the experienced utility of a series of equally painful injections can be measured by simply counting the injections. If all injections are equally aversive, then 20 of them are twice as bad as 10, and a reduction from 20 to 18 and a reduction from 6 to 4 are equally valuable. If the decision utility does not correspond to the experienced utility, then something is wrong with the decision. The same logic played out in the cold hand experiment. An episode of pain that lasts 90 seconds is worse than the first 60 seconds of that episode. If people willingly choose to endure the longer episode, something is wrong with their decision. In my early puzzle, the discrepancy between the decision and the experience originated from diminishing sensitivity. The difference between 18 and 20 is less impressive and appears to be worth less than the difference between 6 and 4 injections. In the cold hand experiment, the error reflects two principles of memory: duration neglect and the peak end rule. The mechanisms are different, but the outcome is the same: a memory and a consequent decision that do not correspond to the experience. Decisions that do not produce the best possible experience and erroneous forecasts of future feelings, both are bad news for believers in the rationality of choice. The cold hand study showed that we cannot fully trust our preferences to reflect our interests, even if they are based on personal experience, and even if the memory of that experience was laid down within the last quarter of an hour. Tastes and decisions are shaped by memories, and the memories can be wrong. The evidence presents a profound challenge to the idea that humans have consistent preferences and know how to maximize them, a cornerstone of the rational agent model. An inconsistency is built into the design of our minds. We have strong preferences about the duration of our experiences of pain and pleasure. We want pain to be brief and pleasure to last. But our memory, a function of System 1, has evolved to represent the most intense moment of an episode of pain or pleasure, the peak, and the feelings when the episode was at its end. A memory that neglects duration will not serve our preference for long pleasure and short pains. Speaking of two selves. You are thinking of your failed marriage entirely from the perspective of the remembering self. A divorce is like a symphony with a screeching sound at the end. The fact that it ended badly does not mean it was all bad. This is a bad case of duration neglect. You are giving the good and the bad part of your experience equal weight, although the good part lasted 10 times as long as the other. Chapter 36. Life as a Story. Early in the days of my work on the measurement of experience, I saw Verdi's opera La Traviata. Known for its gorgeous music, it is also a moving story of the love between a young aristocrat and Violetta, a woman of the demimonde. The young man's father approaches Violetta and convinces her to give up her lover, to protect the honor of the family and the marriage prospects of the young man's sister. In an act of supreme self-sacrifice, Violetta pretends to reject the man she adores. She soon relapses into consumption, the 19th century term for tuberculosis. In the final act, Violetta lies dying, surrounded by a few friends. Her beloved has been alerted and is rushing to Paris to see her. Hearing the news, she is transformed with hope and joy, but she is also deteriorating quickly. No matter how many times you have seen the opera, you are gripped by the tension and fear of the moment. Will the young lover arrive in time? There is a sense that it is immensely important for him to join his beloved before she dies. He does, of course. Some marvelous love duets are sung, and after 10 minutes of glorious music, Violetta dies. On my way home from the opera, I wondered, why do we care so much about those last 10 minutes? I quickly realized that I did not care at all about the length of Violetta's life. If I had been told that she died at age 27, not age 28, as I believed, the news that she had missed a year of happy life would not have moved me at all, but the possibility of missing the last 10 minutes mattered a great deal. Furthermore, the emotion I felt about the lovers' reunion would not have changed if I had learned that they had actually had a week together, rather than 10 minutes. If the lover had come too late, however, La Traviata would have been an altogether different story. A story is about significant events and memorable moments, not about time passing. Duration neglect is normal in a story, and the ending often defines its character. The same core features appear in the rules of narratives and in the memories of colonoscopies, vacations, and films. This is how the remembering self works. It composes stories and keeps them for future reference. It is not only at the opera that we think of life as a story and wish it to end well. When we hear about the death of a woman who had been estranged from her daughter for many years, we want to know whether they were reconciled as death approached. We do not care about the daughter's feelings. It is the narrative of the mother's life that we wish to improve. Caring for people often takes the form of concern for the quality of their stories, not for their feelings. Indeed, we can be deeply moved even by events that change the stories of people who are already dead. We feel pity for a man who died believing in his wife's love for him when we hear that she had a lover for many years and stayed with her husband only for his money. We pity the husband, although he had lived a happy life. We feel the humiliation of a scientist who made an important discovery that was proved false after she died, although she did not experience the humiliation. Most important, of course, we all care intensely for the narrative of our own life and very much want it to be a good story with a decent hero. The psychologist, Ed Diener, and his students wondered whether duration neglect and the peak-end rule would govern evaluations of entire lives. They used a short description of the life of a fictitious character called Jen, a never-married woman with no children, who died instantly and painlessly in an automobile accident. In one version of Jen's story, she was extremely happy throughout her life, which lasted either 30 or 60 years, enjoying her work, taking vacations, spending time with her friends and on her hobbies. Another version added 5 extra years to Jen's life, who now died either when she was 35 or 65. The extra years were described as pleasant, but less so than before. After reading a schematic biography of Jen, each participant answered 2 questions. Taking her life as a whole, how desirable do you think Jen's life was? And how much total happiness or unhappiness would you say that Jen experienced in her life? The results provided clear evidence of both duration neglect and a peak-end effect. In a between-subjects experiment, different participants saw different forms. Doubling the duration of Jen's life had no effect whatsoever on the desirability of her life, or on judgments of the total happiness that Jen experienced. Clearly, her life was represented by a prototypical slice of time, not as a sequence of time slices. As a consequence, her total happiness was the happiness of a typical period in her lifetime, not the sum or integral of happiness over the duration of her life. As expected from this idea, Diener and his students also found a less-is-more effect, a strong indication that an average prototype has been substituted for a sum. Adding 5 slightly happy years to a very happy life caused a substantial drop in evaluations of the total happiness of that life. At my urging, they also collected data on the effect of the extra 5 years in a within-subject experiment. Each participant made both judgments in immediate succession. In spite of my long experience with judgment errors, I did not believe that reasonable people could say that adding 5 slightly happy years to a life would make it substantially worse. I was wrong. The intuition that the disappointing extra 5 years made the whole life worse was overwhelming. The pattern of judgments seemed so absurd that Diener and his students initially thought that it represented the folly of the young people who participated in the experiments. However, the pattern did not change when the parents and older friends of students answered the same questions. In intuitive evaluation of entire lives, as well as brief episodes, peaks and ends matter, but duration does not. The pains of labor and the benefits of vacations always come up as objections to the idea of duration neglect. We all share the intuition that it is much worse for labor to last 24 than 6 hours, and that 6 days at a good resort is better than 3. Duration appears to matter in these situations, but this is only because the quality of the end changes with the length of the episode. The mother is more depleted and helpless after 24 hours than after 6, and the vacationer is more refreshed and rested after 6 days than after 3. What truly matters when we intuitively assess such episodes is the progressive deterioration or improvement of the ongoing experience and how the person feels at the end. Amnesiac vacations. Consider the choice of a vacation. Do you prefer to enjoy a relaxing week at the familiar beach to which you went last year? Or do you hope to enrich your store of memories? Distinct industries have developed to cater to these alternatives. Resorts offer restorative relaxation. Tourism is about helping people construct stories and collect memories. The frenetic picture-taking of many tourists suggests that storing memories is often an important goal, which shapes both the plans for the vacation and the experience of it. The photographer does not view the scene as a moment to be savored, but as a future memory to be designed. Pictures may be useful to the remembering self, though we rarely look at them for very long, or as often as we expected, or even at all. But picture-taking is not necessarily the best way for the tourist's experiencing self to enjoy a view. In many cases, we evaluate touristic vacations by the story and the memories that we expect to store. The word memorable is often used to describe vacation highlights, explicitly revealing the goal of the experience. In other situations, love comes to mind. The declaration that the present moment will never be forgotten, though not always accurate, changes the character of the moment. A self-consciously memorable experience gains a weight and a significance that it would not otherwise have. Ed Diener and his team provided evidence that it is the remembering self that chooses vacations. They asked students to maintain daily diaries and a record of a daily evaluation of their experiences during spring break. The students also provided a global rating of the vacation when it had ended. Finally, they indicated whether or not they intended to repeat or not to repeat the vacation they had just had. Statistical analysis established that the intentions for future vacations were entirely determined by the final evaluation, even when that score did not accurately represent the quality of the experience that was described in the diaries. As in the cold hand experiment, right or wrong, people choose by memory when they decide whether or not to repeat an experience. A thought experiment about your next vacation will allow you to observe your attitude to your experiencing self. At the end of the vacation, All pictures and videos will be destroyed. Furthermore, you will swallow a potion that will wipe out all your memories of the vacation. How would this prospect affect your vacation plans? How much would you be willing to pay for it, relative to a normally memorable vacation? While I have not formally studied the reactions to this scenario, my impressions from discussing it with people is that the elimination of memories greatly reduces the value of the experience. In some cases, people treat themselves as they would treat another amnesiac, choosing to maximize overall pleasure by returning to a place where they have been happy in the past. However, some people say that they would not bother to go at all, revealing that they care only about their remembering self and care less about their amnesiac experiencing self than about an amnesiac stranger. Many point out that they would not send either themselves or another amnesiac to climb mountains or trek through the jungle because these experiences are mostly painful in real time and gain value from the expectation that both the pain and the joy of reaching the goal will be memorable. For another thought experiment, imagine you face a painful operation during which you will remain conscious. You are told you will scream in pain and beg the surgeon to stop. However, you are promised an amnesiac drug that will completely wipe out any memory of the episode. How do you feel about such a prospect? Here again, my informal observation is that most people are remarkably indifferent to the pains of their experiencing self. Some say they don't care at all. Others share my feeling, which is that I feel pity for my suffering self, but not more than I would feel for a stranger in pain. Odd as it may seem, I am my remembering self, and the experiencing self who does my living is like a stranger to me. Speaking of life as a story. He is desperately trying to protect the narrative of his story of a life of integrity, which is endangered by the latest episode. The length to which he was willing to go for a one-night encounter is a sign of total duration neglect. You seem to be devoting your entire vacation to the construction of memories. Perhaps you should put away the camera and enjoy the moment, even if it's not very memorable. She is an Alzheimer's patient. She no longer maintains a narrative of her life, but her experiencing self is still sensitive to beauty and gentleness. Chapter 37. Experienced Well-Being. When I became interested in the study of well-being about 15 years ago, I quickly found out that almost everything that was known about the subject drew on the answers of millions of people to minor variations of a survey question, which was generally accepted as a measure of happiness. The question is clearly addressed to your remembering self, which is invited to think about your life. All things considered, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole these days? Having come to the topic of well-being from the study of the mistaken memories of colonoscopies and painfully cold hands, I was naturally suspicious of global satisfaction with life as a valid measure of well-being. As the remembering self had not proved to be a good witness in my experiments, I focused on the well-being of the experiencing self. I proposed that it made sense to say that Helen was happy in the month of March if she spent most of her time engaged in activities that she would rather continue than stop, little time in situations she wished to escape, and, very important because life is short, not too much time in a neutral state in which she would not care either way. There are many different experiences we would rather continue than stop, including both mental and physical pleasures. One of the examples I had in mind for a situation that Helen would wish to continue is total absorption in a task, which Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi calls flow. a state that some artists experience in their creative moments and that many other people achieve when enthralled by a film, a book, or a crossword puzzle. Interruptions are not welcome in any of these situations. I also had memories of a happy early childhood in which I always cried when my mother came to tear me away from my toys to take me to the park, and cried again when she took me away from the swings and the slide. The resistance to interruption was a sign I had been having a good time, both with my toys and with the swings. I proposed to measure Helen's objective happiness precisely as we assessed the experience of the two colonoscopy patients by evaluating a profile of the well-being she experienced over successive moments of her life. In this, I was following Edgeworth's hedonometer method of a century earlier. In my initial enthusiasm for this approach, I was inclined to dismiss Helen's remembering self as an error-prone witness to the actual well-being of her experiencing self. I suspected this position was too extreme, which it turned out to be, but it was a good start. Experienced well-being. I assembled a dream team that included three other psychologists of different specialities and one economist, and we set out together to develop a measure of the well-being of the experiencing self. A continuous record of experience was unfortunately impossible. A person cannot live normally while constantly reporting her experiences. The closest alternative was experience sampling, a method that Csikszentmihalyi had invented. Technology has advanced since its first uses. Experience sampling is now implemented by programming an individual's cell phone to beep or vibrate at random intervals during the day. The phone then presents a brief menu of questions about what the respondent was doing and who was with her when she was interrupted. The participant is also shown rating scales to report the intensity of various feelings: happiness, tension, anger, worry, engagement, physical pain, and others. Experience sampling is expensive and burdensome, although less disturbing than most people initially expect. Answering the questions takes very little time. A more practical alternative was needed, so we developed a method we called the Day Reconstruction Method, DRM. We hoped it would approximate the results of experience sampling and provide additional information about the way people spend their time. Participants, all women in the early studies, were invited to a 2-hour session. We first asked them to relive the previous day in detail, breaking it up into episodes like scenes in a film. Later, they answered menus of questions about each episode based on the experience sampling method. They selected activities in which they were engaged from a list and indicated the one to which they paid most attention. They also listed the individuals they had been with and rated the intensity of several feelings on separate 0 to 6 scales. 0 equals the absence of the feeling, 6 equals most intense feeling. Our method drew on evidence that people who are able to retrieve a past situation in detail are also able to relive the feelings that accompanied it, even experiencing their earlier physiological indications of emotion. We assumed that our participants would fairly accurately recover the feelings of a prototypical moment of the episode. Several comparisons with experience sampling confirmed the validity of the DRM. Because the participants also reported the times at which episodes began and ended, we were able to compute a duration-weighted measure of their feeling during the entire waking day. Longer episodes counted more than short episodes in our summary measure of daily effect. Our questionnaire also included measures of life satisfaction, which we interpreted as the satisfaction of the remembering self. We used the DRM to study the determinants of both emotional well-being and life satisfaction in several thousand women in the United States, France, and Denmark. The experience of a moment or an episode is not easily represented by a single happiness value. There are many variants of positive feelings, including love, joy, engagement, hope, amusement, and many others. Negative emotions also come in many varieties, including anger, shame, depression, and loneliness. Although positive and negative emotions exist at the same time, it is possible to classify most moments of life as ultimately positive or negative. We could identify unpleasant episodes by comparing the ratings of positive and negative adjectives. We called an episode unpleasant if a negative feeling was assigned to a higher rating than all the positive feelings. We found that American women spent about 19% of the time in an unpleasant state, somewhat higher than French women, 16%, or Danish women, 14%. We called the percentage of time that an individual spends in an unpleasant state the U index. For example, an individual who spent 4 hours of a 16-hour waking day in an unpleasant state would have a U index of 25%. The appeal of the U index is that it is based not on a rating scale, but on an objective measurement of time. If the U index for a population drops from 20% to 18%, you can infer that the total time that the population spent in emotional discomfort or pain has diminished by a tenth. A striking observation was the extent of inequality in the distribution of emotional pain. About half of our participants reported going through an entire day without experiencing an unpleasant episode. On the other hand, a significant minority of the population experienced considerable emotional distress for much of the day. It appears that a small fraction of the population does most of the suffering, whether because of physical or mental illness, an unhappy temperament, or the misfortunes and personal tragedies in their life. A U index can also be computed for activities. For example, we can measure the proportion of time that people spend in a negative emotional state while commuting, working, or interacting with their parents, spouses, or children. For 1,000 American women in a Midwestern city, the U index was 29% for the morning commute, 27% for work, 24% for childcare, 18% for housework, 12% for socializing, 12% for TV watching, and 5% for sex. The U index was higher by about 6% on weekdays than it was on weekends, mostly because on weekends people spend less time in activities they dislike and do not suffer the tension and stress associated with work. The biggest surprise was the emotional experience of the time spent with one's children, which for American women was slightly less enjoyable than doing housework. Here we found one of the few contrasts between French and American women. French women spend less time with their children, but enjoy it more, perhaps because they have more access to childcare and spend less of the afternoon driving children to various activities. An individual's mood at any moment depends on her temperament and overall happiness. But emotional well-being also fluctuates considerably over the day and the week. The mood of the moment depends primarily on the current situation. Mood at work, for example, is largely unaffected by the factors that influence general job satisfaction, including benefits and status. More important are situational factors, such as an opportunity to socialize with coworkers, exposure to loud noise, time pressure, a significant source of negative effect, and the immediate presence of a boss. In our first study, the only thing that was worse than being alone. Attention is key. Our emotional state is largely determined by what we attend to, and we are normally focused on our current activity and immediate environment. There are exceptions where the quality of subjective experience is dominated by recurrent thoughts rather than by the events of the moment. When happily in love, we may feel joy even when caught in traffic, and if grieving, we may remain depressed when watching a funny movie. In normal circumstances, however, we draw pleasure and pain from what is happening at the moment if we attend to it. To get pleasure from eating, for example, you must notice that you are doing it. We found that French and American women spent about the same amount of time eating, but for French women, eating was twice as likely to be focal as it was for American women. The Americans were far more prone to combine eating with other activities, and their pleasure from eating was correspondingly diluted. These observations have implications for both individuals and society. The use of time is one of the areas of life over which people have some control. Few individuals can will themselves to have a sunnier disposition, but some may be able to arrange their lives to spend less of their day commuting and more time doing things they enjoy with people they like. The feelings associated with different activities suggest that another way to improve experience is to switch time from passive leisure, such as TV watching, to more active forms of leisure, including socializing and exercise. From the social perspective, improved transportation for the labor force, availability of childcare for working women, and improved socializing opportunities for the elderly may be relatively efficient ways to reduce the U index of society. Even a reduction by 1% would be a significant achievement, amounting to millions of hours of avoided suffering. Combined national surveys of time use and of experienced well-being can inform social policy in multiple ways. The economist on our team, Alan Krueger, took the lead in an effort to introduce elements of this method into national statistics. Measures of experienced well-being are now routinely used in large-scale national surveys in the United States, Canada, and Europe, and the Gallup World Poll has extended these measurements to millions of respondents in the United States and in more than 150 countries. The polls elicit reports of the emotions experienced during the previous day, though in less detail than the DRM. The gigantic samples allow extremely fine analyses, which have confirmed the importance of situational factors, physical health, and social contact in experienced well-being. Not surprisingly, a headache will make a person miserable, and the second best predictor of the feelings of a day is whether a person did or did not have contacts with friends or relatives. It is only a slight exaggeration to say that happiness is the experience of spending time with people you love and who love you. The Gallup data permit a comparison of two aspects of well-being. The well-being that people experience as they live their lives. The judgment they make when they evaluate their life. Gallup's life evaluation is measured by a question known as the Cantrill Self-Anchoring Striving Scale. Please imagine a ladder with steps numbered from 0 at the bottom to 10 at the top. The top of the ladder represents the best possible life for you, and the bottom of the ladder represents the worst possible life for you. On which step of the ladder would you say you personally feel you stand at this time? Some aspects of life have more effect on the evaluation of one's life than on the experience of living. Educational attainment is an example. More education is associated with higher evaluation of one's life, but not with greater experienced well-being. Indeed, at least in the United States, the more educated tend to report higher stress. On the other hand, ill health has a much stronger adverse effect on experienced well-being than on life evaluation. Living with children also imposes a significant cost on the currency of daily feelings. Reports of stress and anger are common among parents, but the adverse effects on life evaluation are smaller. Religious participation also has relatively greater favorable impact on both positive affect and stress reduction than on life evaluation. Surprisingly, however, religion provides no reduction of feelings of depression or worry. An analysis of more than 450,000 responses to the Gallup Healthways Well-Being Index, a daily survey of 1,000 Americans, provides a surprisingly definite answer to the most frequently asked question in well-being research. Can money buy happiness? The conclusion is that being poor makes one miserable, and that being rich may enhance one's life satisfaction, but does not, on average, improve experienced well-being. Severe poverty amplifies the experienced effects of other misfortunes of life. In particular, illness is much worse for the very poor than for those who are more comfortable. A headache increases the proportion reporting sadness and worry from 19% to 38% for individuals in the top two-thirds of the income distribution. The corresponding numbers for the poorest tenth are 38% and 70%, a higher baseline level and a much larger increase. Significant differences between the very poor and others are also found for the effects of divorce and loneliness. Furthermore, the beneficial effects of the weekend on experienced well-being are significantly smaller for the very poor than for most everyone else. The satiation level beyond which experienced well-being no longer increases was a household income of about $75,000 in high-cost areas. It could be less in areas where the cost of living is lower. The average increase of experienced well-being associated with incomes beyond that level was precisely zero. This is surprising because higher income undoubtedly permits the purchase of many pleasures, including vacations in interesting places and opera tickets, as well as an improved living environment. Why do these added pleasures not show up in reports of emotional experience? A plausible interpretation is that higher income is associated with a reduced ability to enjoy the small pleasures of life. There is suggestive evidence in favor of this idea. Priming students with the idea of wealth reduces the pleasure their face expresses as they eat a bar of chocolate. There is a clear contrast between the effects of income on experienced well-being and on life satisfaction. Higher income brings with it higher satisfaction, well beyond the point at which it ceases to have any positive effect on experience. The general conclusion is as clear for well-being as it was for colonoscopies. People's evaluations of their lives and their actual experience may be related, but they are also different. Life satisfaction is not a flawed measure of their experienced well-being, as I thought some years ago. It is something else entirely. Speaking of experienced well-being, the objective of policy should be to reduce human suffering. We aim for a lower U index in society. Dealing with depression and extreme poverty should be a priority. The easiest way to increase happiness is to control your use of time. Can you find more time to do the things you enjoy doing? Beyond the satiation level of income, you can buy more pleasurable experiences, but you will lose some of your ability to enjoy the less expensive ones. Chapter 38. Thinking about life. Figure 16 on the PDF is taken from an analysis by Andrew Clark, Ed Diener, and Yanis Georgelis of the German Socioeconomic Panel, in which the same respondents were asked every year about their satisfaction with their life. Respondents also reported major changes that had occurred in their circumstances during the preceding year. The graph shows the level of satisfaction reported by people around the time they got married. The graph reliably evokes nervous laughter from audiences, and the nervousness is easy to understand. After all, people who decide to get married do so either because they expect it will make them happier or because they hope that making a tie permanent will maintain the present state of bliss. In the useful term introduced by Daniel Gilbert and Timothy Wilson, the decision to get married reflects, for many people, a massive error of affective forecasting. On their wedding day, the bride and the groom know that the rate of divorce is high and that the incidence of marital disappointment is even higher, but they do not believe that these statistics apply to them. The startling news of Figure 16 is the steep decline of life satisfaction. The graph is commonly interpreted as tracing a process of adaptation in which the early joys of marriage quickly disappear as the experiences become routine. However, another approach is possible, which focuses on heuristics of judgment. Here we ask what happens in people's minds when they are asked to evaluate their life. The questions, how satisfied are you with your life as a whole? And how happy are you these days? Are not as simple as, what is your telephone number? How do survey participants manage to answer the question in a few seconds, as all do? It will help to think of this as another judgment. As is also the case for other questions, some people may have a ready-made answer, which they have produced on another occasion in which they evaluated their life. Others, probably the majority, do not quickly find a response to the exact question they were asked, and automatically make their task easier by substituting the answer to another question. System 1 is at work. When we look at Figure 16 in this light, it takes on a different meaning. The answers to many simple questions can be substituted for a global evaluation of life. You remember the study in which students who had just been asked how many dates they had in the previous month reported their happiness these days as if dating was the only significant fact in their life. In another well-known experiment in the same vein, Norbert Schwartz and his colleagues invited subjects to the lab to complete a questionnaire on life satisfaction. Before they began that task, however, he asked them to photocopy a sheet of paper for him. Half the respondents found a dime on the copying machine, planted there by the experimenter. The minor lucky incident caused a marked improvement in the subjects' reported satisfaction with their life as a whole. A mood heuristic is one way to answer life satisfaction questions. The dating survey and the coin on the machine experiment demonstrated, as intended, that the responses to global well-being questions should be taken with a grain of salt. But of course, your current mood is not the only thing that comes to mind when you are asked to evaluate your life. You are likely to be reminded of significant events in your recent past or near future, of recurrent concerns such as the health of a spouse or the bad company that your teenager keeps, of important achievements and painful failures. A few ideas that are relevant to the question will occur to you. Many others will not. Even when it is not influenced by completely irrelevant accidents, such as the coin on the machine, the score that you quickly assign to your life is determined by a small sample of highly available ideas, not by a careful weighting of the domains of your life. People who recently married, or are expecting to marry in the near future, are likely to retrieve that fact when asked a general question about their life. Because marriage is almost always voluntary in the United States, almost everyone who is reminded of his or her recent or forthcoming marriage will be happy with the idea. Attention is the key to the puzzle. Figure 16 can be read as a graph of the likelihood that people will think of their recent or forthcoming marriage when asked about their life.